I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American empire, national security state operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Russ, it's great to be here. I'm going to try to hold myself together, not get emotional here, but I want to harken back to your statement about Georgia.
Yeah.
And about the Trump voter.
Yeah.
And they should be very afraid, very afraid. Trump and you are all we have left, Rush. We've spent our lives voting for these people because they're not them. And we just can't do it anymore. We're tired of being stabbed in the back, Rush. It's better to have an enemy that's in front of you than a friend that's behind you that's just going to stab you. They do it every time. We have a Republican-controlled state, and they won't do an audit of the vote. They won't. They just basically told every Georgian that they don't care. We were in Washington on Saturday. Me and my 33-year-old son, we saw more people than we've ever seen in our lifetime, ever. And we're season ticket holders for the Ravens, for God's sakes. I've been in crowds of 80,000 people. I've been to Steelers games, for goodness sakes. I have never seen so many people. But were there any Republicans there? No. None. None.
But wait. What? There were no Republicans. What was this thing that you went to?
A week ago Saturday in Washington, D.C., the mega rally. There must have been hundreds of thousands.
Okay, it's a MAGA rally, and there were, you mean no elected Republicans? Is that what you mean?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Our party leadership, quote unquote, if this were a Democrat rally, they would all be there. They were there for the anti-Tea Party movement, walking hand in hand up the steps.
Yep.
No one stands for us, Rush. Only you and Donald Trump. God forbid, what do we have left? I love my president. I am not a revolutionary, Rush, but I will die for my president. This man has given more to this country than anybody, and he has no need to. None. He's a billionaire. He doesn't need this.
That's exactly right.
It's disheartening.
What you just heard was a rather disturbing, at least in my opinion, call in to the Rush Limbaugh show in the aftermath of Donald Trump's failed bid to remain president of the United States of America. The caller was extremely distraught, on the verge of tears, explaining that he would die for Donald Trump. Moreover, he expressed the sentiment that only Donald Trump and Rush Limbaugh are looking out for voters like himself. Limbaugh has since passed, succumbing to his battle with lung cancer on February 17th, 2021. Rush Limbaugh may be gone, but as that call-in shows, he cultivated a rabid, fervent, some would even go as far as to say fanatical listenership who remain with us and were hugely influenced by the right-wing talk radio hosts' controversial tirades over the years. Scholar John K. Wilson, author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason, joins us on this edition of Parallax Views to to discuss the toxic legacy that Rush Limbaugh has left behind. All that and more on this edition of the program. And now on to the conversation with John K. Wilson, author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. Welcome to Parallax Views. John K. Wilson, author of a number of books, including the book that we'll probably be talking quite a bit about on this edition of the program, The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. John, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Thanks for talking with me.
So, John, before we get into Rush Limbaugh, maybe you could give a little background to my listeners about yourself and the scholarship that you do.
Sure. Well, I study a lot about politics, but my primary field is actually academia. So I have a PhD in higher education, and I write a lot about campus free speech and academic freedom issues. But I've always had a lot of interest in politics. I wrote a book in the 1990s about Newt Gingrich, and I've written other books about Barack Obama and Donald Trump. And I wrote about Rush Limbaugh primarily because he's someone I listened to a lot in my, as I tried to study conservatives and understand conservative thinking. And so Limbaugh was really the center of the influences in the media on conservatives. And so I listened to him out of a mixture of abhorrence and fascination. And that really led me into writing a book about him 10 years ago.
So as everyone listening to this knows, Rush Limbaugh recently passed away. But I want to ask right out the chute, why that title, The Most Dangerous Man in America? Because I could see some people thinking, oh, is he over-exaggerating? But there's a specific reason you called it that.
Right. That's not my title, per se. That was something that Rush Limbaugh liked to refer to himself as, that he would claim liberals called him that. And in fact, Ronald Reagan wrote him a fawning letter in 1992 telling Limbaugh that, you know, that you're called the most dangerous man in America, and so was I. And told him not to be bothered by it. And so I think it is in many ways a sense that, you know, Rush Limbaugh was the successor to Reagan in the conservative movement in America, that he had that kind of incredible influence and popularity. And that idea of being dangerous, of being called dangerous by the left, is something that Limbaugh really enjoyed, that he embraced the idea that he was a threat to liberalism.
Now, I like the subtitle too, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. You know, a lot of people will talk today about how figures like Ben Shapiro use these ideas or terms like facts don't care about your feelings, I'm just being logical, blah, 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 blah. That doesn't start with Ben Shapiro. I would say it even goes back to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan would always invoke common sense. He would just say, oh, well, it's just common sense. And I think that Limbaugh probably did that too. You know, oh, well, I'm making the reasonable argument. It's these unreasonable moonbat liberals. But why is it that it's really the other way around, that Limbaugh and his sort of ilk were the ones assaulting reason, not the left?
Right. And I think it's important for progressives to sort of take back the things that a lot of the right has stolen, whether it's reason, rationality, free speech, all of these things that in many cases conservatives can pretend to be attached to. But I think it's important for progressives not to give up on these concepts just because conservatives pretend like they care about facts. And of course, the reality is that they often don't. That a lot of my book was devoted to trying to show the ways that Limbaugh would fabricate things, would give false examples. And in many ways, one of the fascinating things about Limbaugh was that he would even invent statistics about his own accuracy that were completely fabricated, which continued to this day. Just this morning on his show, they were playing some bits of his old speeches, and at every commercial break bumper, they would have an announcer say Rush was proven to be 99.8% right. Which was a statistic that Limbaugh literally made up as a joke, but it's something that his audience believed, or a lot of his audience believed, that he would say that there was the Sullivan Group had done this audit of his opinions that showed they were 99.8% right. And this was all made up. Sullivan Group was a brokerage firm owned by a friend of his who was a talk show host with him and Sacramento when he started off. And so he would just use this fictional opinion audit to prove to everyone in his audience that he was right about everything. And that was the way
Limbaugh. And then he would also say he was joking if he was like probably pressed about it or whatnot.
No. He never said that. Okay. He just put it out there. And if anyone had ever challenged him about it, I'm sure he would have said, hey, it's just a joke. Why can't you take a joke? Which was the usual way he dealt with when he was challenged on saying something false or bigoted or hateful. He would respond with that it's a joke defense, but no one ever challenged him about this, actually.
I was going to say in that regard, the reason I mentioned that was because, you know, Limbaugh is one of these people that when he would make appearances at, say, the national radio convention or national talk radio conventions, he would say, well, I'm an entertainer. And Glenn Beck also had a tendency to do that as well. What do you make of that argument that, oh, I'm just an entertainer, that sort of line from Limbaugh and others?
Well, it is partly true. One of his achievements in radio was being a person who brought entertainment to talk show, to the political realm. He took the techniques of morning DJs, in some cases shock jocks, people who were just in it to get jokes. And he used a lot of those techniques, parody songs and all of those things, and applied them to politics. So in some sense, he was an entertainer, but of course, he was much more than an entertainer. He was an ideologue trying to push a political perspective. And that whole it's an entertainer line became a way, I think, for him to evade responsibility, that he didn't have to meet the standards of objectivity or news or accuracy or truth. He could always, when he made a mistake or offended someone, he could fall back on the idea that he was just an entertainer. But he was really offended if you called him that. You know, when people would call him that, he would be very offended at that he wanted to be something much more than an entertainer, and he was. He was the leader of the conservative movement.
If we could, just stepping back a moment, I want to get into some of his fabrications, but first, could you talk a little bit about Limbaugh's, I guess, rise to prominence and his early days in radio?
Sure. Well, Limbaugh was unsuccessful at radio for a long time. He grew up in Missouri. He came from a very prestigious family of lawyers and judges, and he was really, in some ways, the black sheep of the family because he dropped out of college. He was not successful at radio. He worked in promotions for the Kansas City Royals for a while. And then finally, in his mid-30s, he got a break doing a talk show in Sacramento. And that's where he really came to the forefront in 1984. And by 1988, he is advanced to a national syndication deal, moves to New York, and that's when he shoots to prominence. He very quickly becomes an instant hit in the in talk radio, and so from there he writes best-selling books. He's an incredibly powerful voice among the right, but he really is, you know, holds the line as the number one talk radio guy for more than 30 years. And so it's an incredible kind of career that he had. And a lot of it reflected I think that the desire of the conservative audience to have someone to give them conservative views and tell them they didn't need to hear anything else.
Would you say there's any parallels between Limbaugh and prior broadcasters, or maybe how was he different than a lot of prior broadcasters?
Well, he had some similarities with some of them. He really modeled himself on non-political, you know, entertainment DJs like Larry Lujack out of WLS in Chicago. That was his idol. And you could tell the kind of comedy bits, that was the kind of thing he did. Politically, you know, he had a lot of similarities to things like people like Paul Harvey or other people who had sort of preceded him in conservative media, like Jesse Helms, who actually was a powerful TV station manager before he became a senator and a conservative politician. So, you know, Rush Limbaugh was in some ways following those footsteps, but in many ways he charted his own path. He took this path of entertainment, being a DJ, which wasn't traditionally seen as anything connected to conservatives, and he applied it to this new talk radio format and made it an incredible success. The other thing he did that was very unusual and that he really innovated was he made the show all about him. Traditionally, a lot of talk radio was about having callers and having guests and interviewing them. And Rush was somebody who never liked having his ideas challenged. He always loved the sound of his own voice. And so he was able to make a successful format where he would be the center of the show. He would let callers in occasionally. On very rare occasions, he would have political guests. But, you know, it was all about Rush Limbaugh, and that's the way Limbaugh wanted it.
I was going to add to that, too. I was just talking to another guest about maybe the similarities between certain TV talk shows and Limbaugh. I don't know if you have any comment on that, but I'm thinking specifically of characters like maybe Morton Downey Jr. or in California, Wally George, who sort of had this, you know, combative right-wing personality going on in their shows.
Well, yeah. And interestingly, Morton Downey Jr. was the guy who had the talk show that Rush Limbaugh replaced. He had the talk show in Sacramento when he was fired for making a racist joke about a San Francisco councilman, and he refused to apologize for it, and he was fired, and Rush Limbaugh was the guy they brought in to replace him. And then Bernardino Jr. went on to do more of the traditional kind of TV shock approach. But, you know, Limbaugh took some of that kind of approach, but in many ways he was trying to shock people with his political views, that he was trying to get a rise out of people and be controversial. And so he had that similar kind of spirit that he wanted to challenge what he saw as the establishment, the status quo, the mainstream media, and that he was going to present himself as the alternative to that for his audience.
What would you say are the core aspects of Limbaugh's conservatism that maybe set him apart from prior conservatives? I mean, I wouldn't put Limbaugh in the same camp as even conservatives that I highly disagree with on things. For instance, I don't think that a William F. Buckley and a Rush Limbaugh are necessarily the same, at least in their aesthetic approach to things.
No, and I think there's a very interesting, because Limbaugh really was in some ways the intellectual successor to William F. Buckley and the conservative movement in terms of being the person on the media who was most influential for what conservatives thought. But of course, he was radically different from Buckley. Buckley was an intellectual and deeply concerned with presenting himself as being smarter than everyone else. Limbaugh was someone who could speak much more to the people, that he was someone who could communicate to a much broader range of Americans than William F. Buckley ever could. And part of that reflected, I think, that Limbaugh was anti-intellectual, that he was anti-education, that he distrusted scientists and elites and academics and all these people he saw as kind of the political enemies for the right. And so what he brought was much more of a, this anti-intellectualism to the conservative movement that you see even today. It's the idea of someone who's appealing to a mass audience, who's playing fast and loose with whatever statistics and arguments that that he wants. And so Limbaugh was very much someone who wanted to be a conservative ideologue. That's the one aspect where he didn't rebel from his parents. He came from a conservative family. He was always a conservative. He never really changed his political views at all. But he was the person who was able to translate conservatism to a mass audience, much like Reagan was able to do in the political realm. Limbaugh was able to do that in the on the radio.
What do you consider Limbaugh's main, I guess, contributions to American conservatism, or the views that he really pushed into maybe the popular discussion?
Well, I think a lot of what Limbaugh's contributions are that he popularized conservatism. He brought it to a much larger audience. But of course, it wasn't just the traditional conservative free market economics necessarily in a lot of ways. It was a, you know, it was a kind of old-fashioned conservatism, I think, that in some ways reached back to the John Birchers and those kind of, that kind of approach to the conservatives, that that he was the opposite of William F. Buckley in that sense, that he was trying to, that he was very much espousing these kind of racist, sexist, homophobic ideas on his show, using those things for laughs, and really pushing this conservatism in this anti-intellectual direction, as well as this, you know, towards a lot of conspiracy theories. He was also a forerunner of a lot of the, those kind of conservative conspiracy theories that that really made the rise of Donald Trump possible, because Donald Trump was somebody who could really espouse this kind of pseudo-populist, these conspiracy theories, these bigoted ideas openly. And I think Trump was able to do that because Rush Limbaugh had literally paved the way for a candidate like that to succeed within the Republican Party.
I was going to say, in regards to the conspiracy theory aspect, he may not have always worded things the same way as maybe like an Alex Jones, but really this is a person who sort of believed or pushed a belief in the elite globalists and the, you know, the CFR types are, you know, out to get us, the average Americans. And there is sort of a Bircher quality to all of it.
Right. And he was nowhere near where Alex Jones was. You know, Limbaugh was not a professional conspiracy theorist. He would use these in a lot of ways. He would put conspiracy theories into his shows, often using humor as the protection for it, where you could say he was just joking, where he would make jokes about, you know, the Clintons killing people and about Barack Obama and his background and all these kinds of things. So, you know, conspiracy theories were not a huge part of the show. They were more on the margins, but they became increasingly part of the way Limbaugh operated, especially after the election of Donald Trump, and where Limbaugh was much more aggressive in embracing conspiracy theories. And I think he was reflecting more of who his true self was, that for a long time, he sort of suppressed some of those ideas that he only let in on the margins. And then as a conspiracy theorist like Donald Trump was in power, he was much more willing to push those boundaries, perhaps because so many of his competitors in talk radio were doing the same thing.
Now, in regards to what maybe did make him actually dangerous, what were some of the views he espoused, especially for my younger audience? Because I feel like Limbaugh maybe slowed down in the past few years, or he sort of had cornered maybe a baby boomer market. Younger audiences, I don't know, are as familiar with him. What were some of the things he pushed that we still hear about today. I'm thinking particularly of things like climate change and the ideas he pushed in that regard.
But I think climate change is one area where he was incredibly influential within the Republican Party. The Republican Party, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, was fairly moderate on environmental issues. They didn't want government regulation, but they weren't in denial of the existence of scientific facts to the extent they are now. And Limbaugh was, to a great extent, responsible for that. He was someone who pushed very hard against the possibility that climate change was a real thing, something that was, you know, much easier to do in the late 80s, early 90s, when there was a little more uncertainty about some of the scientific evidence. But he's never altered at all from that perspective. He opposed the concept of climate change, partly because he saw it as a conspiracy of the socialists, the leftists were going to try and destroy business by pretending that climate change was a problem. And so he was unalterably opposed to that. And it also reflected his religious beliefs, that he simply didn't believe it was possible that God would allow, you know, humans to destroy the planet. And so Limbaugh came at this where he literally didn't care what the science said. And he strongly opposed this. And he really, you know, for a generation of conservatives, he associated the words environmentalist with wacko. That was the way he would always talk about it, the environmentalist wackos. And that became his way of disparaging any concern about the dangers of global warming or climate change. So he was incredibly, I think, influential within the Republican Party that, you know, what might have been a debate about how do we deal with climate change instead has become, in American politics, a debate about whether climate change exists at all, and the absolute denial of that by conservatives like Limbaugh.
You mentioned that he would use these sort of snarl words to describe environmentalists. You know, oh, they're just the wackos and the moon bats. He did this a lot in areas even different than climate change. For example, I think he helped popularize the term feminazis. It seems like he was a master at using the snarl word, and that combined with the fact that really his show is an echo chamber. He didn't have to answer to anyone on that show. There were no real debates between him and guests. It was him and his callers.
Right. And he was very careful in screening his callers to make sure that liberals didn't get through to challenge him. In fact, he got very angry whenever a liberal was able to sneak through to the call screener to get to him, because he would accuse them of lying to get on the air and all that. He was someone who did not take being challenged, and he absolutely was an innovator in language of terms like feminazis, which you know, really extraordinary kinds of comparisons of basically saying that feminists were like Nazis and using this term to apply to everyone, every feminist topic. He would bring up feminazis and again, this was for him part of this humor, the idea that using these kind of insults that he would say, well, he could say that it was a joke, but he never really had to. He was, again, never really challenged on this idea of comparing all feminists to Nazis. It was just a basic part of his vocabulary, and something that for conservatives became a natural part of thing. And this, I think, contributed a lot to the kind of divisive discourse that we see today, that, you know, sometimes it gets blamed on social media, but really it started with Rush Limbaugh, where you know, comparing your opponents to Nazis was the foundation of his show in some ways. And so you have that kind of discourse of hate that Rush Limbaugh really innovated in a lot of ways.
I think what's interesting as well, especially about that point of his show sort of being an echo chamber all its own, is that we're currently in a moment where you have certain Republicans saying, alternative facts, or, you know, you have to respect my opinion. And it seems like by respect my opinion, a lot of right-wing or conservative elements mean my opinion is just as valid as yours, even if the facts don't really reflect that. Having that echo chamber really does create an environment where no one can challenge you. And then when people do start challenging you, you just don't accept that. You don't accept that reality. It's almost like Limbaugh created his own reality for conservatives. Oh, yeah.
Well, he created his own reality, and he created sort of an ideology of telling his listeners only to listen to me. And he would sometimes explicitly do that on climate change. You know, he would instruct his listeners, don't listen to the scientists and all these things. You can't trust that. Don't trust the media. And that was one of the reasons why he actually liked to sometimes read from articles by liberals or read about what liberals were saying, because he wanted to, in some ways, inoculate his audience. He wanted to tell them, no, this isn't, if you hear this, this isn't true. Here's the real thing that I'm going to tell you. But he really wanted to become, the source of information, and hopefully the only source of information for most of his listeners. He didn't want them to listen to the mainstream media or to trust anything they said. And so he really tried to be all inclusive. He wanted to make his show the source of information about everything political for his audience, so that they wouldn't turn to other places. And then, of course, you know, as time went by, because of his success, the conservative movement, conservative media created all of these Limbaugh imitators who filled the ranks of the talk radio stations, as well as cable news and the internet and Fox News shows. And so you had what Limbaugh really could only have dreamed of, which was these kind of 24-hour, 7 days a week silos where people would only hear the conservative side of the news. And that was really inspired by Limbaugh, and it was in some ways his dream of what the conservative movement would be conservatives only listening to each other about what the news really was.
Is it fair to say that Limbaugh is sort of like the talk radio version of a political demagogue?
Yeah, I think that's true in a lot of ways, because he shares that same kind of spirit and has those similarities with Donald Trump of that kind of connecting with a mass audience, of trying to control the narrative and telling people, and in some ways not caring what the truth is, not having to care what the truth is, but simply reciting this ideology to get this point. And I think for Limbaugh, you know, he did it out of both ratings, but also a sense of ideology. I think he always distrusted Donald Trump a little bit, because Trump, of course, was a con artist. Trump didn't believe in conservative values or conservative ideas. He believed in Donald Trump. And so for a lot of conservatives, the Never Trumpers, they saw Donald Trump as somebody you couldn't trust. I think Limbaugh saw him very differently. He was leery of him before eventually embracing him, but he knew he wasn't a conservative. But I think Limbaugh saw a lot of himself in Donald Trump, that kind of political demagogue was a shtick that Limbaugh had perfected in many ways. And so he could admire the ability of Trump to really do that, to apply that same kind of approach to political elections directly.
It's interesting, because when talking about Limbaugh and Trump with others, I've had people try and argue, well, his support of Trump shows that he didn't really believe in anything. That, you know, as soon as the Trump train went off, Rush Limbaugh switched from supporting Ted Cruz and the likes of those kind of Republicans to going straight to Trump. How would you respond to that sort of idea that Limbaugh never really believed in anything? Why do you push back on that?
Well, I think because he, you know, it's really hard to do this as an act for 33 years. It's really hard to pretend to be a conservative 15 hours a week for 30 plus years. And to be honest, when he started, this wasn't a lucrative business. You could make that argument about that, that as a cynical ploy, you could make that argument about somebody like Glenn Beck, who is, you know, much more squishy in his conservative politics, as well as somebody who came along and saw Rush Limbaugh as a, you know, as an approach as an economic engine. But Limbaugh was doing this before it was profitable to be doing this. So it seems pretty clear to me that that these are his values. Now, sure, there is a certain amount of, you know, entertainment value that he's trying to project, that that he's saying things to be shocking or provocative at times, but I think he really does believe a lot of this. Now, the reason why he embraced Limbaugh, even though he knew Limbaugh wasn't a conservative, was that...
You mean Trump?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Limbaugh embraced Trump, even though he knew Trump wasn't a conservative, was because that... I think, first of all, Limbaugh is very careful not to get too involved in primary conflicts. He doesn't want to upset a really large audience that's divided among lots of supporters. So he tries to play it safe a lot of the time. But I think he also really liked the fact that Trump offended liberals. And that was the key thing for him. It didn't matter whether Trump actually believed the things that he was espousing, as long as he was pretending to believe in conservative values and offending the progressives at the same time. So that was, I think, what Limbaugh saw in Trump.
I was going to add to that. One of the things I think we live with when it comes to Rush Limbaugh's legacy is conservatism, less as an ideology of conserving things and traditions and values, and more being based around a sort of politics of cruelty. In other words, just hate the liberals, you know. Would you agree with that sort of sentiment?
Well, yeah, and there was a lot of kind of a vicious side of Limbaugh. Sometimes could get him in trouble when he went after the Georgetown law student Sandra Fluke and called her a slut and a prostitute for supporting Obamacare. Coverage of contraceptives. So, you know, that was sort of in his more extreme moments. He had a vicious streak in him, and he was someone who was in many ways filled with hate towards the liberal side and towards his ideological enemies. But at the same time, he was someone who had a lot of love for conservatives. That he was. You know, he believed in these conservative values to a great extent, and the fact that he was a hypocrite who didn't live up to a lot of those kind of conservative values, that didn't, I think, bother him so much, because he saw himself as this culture warrior, as someone fighting for these conservative traditional American values against all of these enemies in liberal America.
In regards to those fabrications that Limbaugh would make that you mentioned earlier, what do you think are the ones that had the most impact, or what are some specific examples of fabrications that Limbaugh would make on air?
Well, I think a lot of it was invoking a lot of the traditional conservative media, in many ways doing the things like Donald Trump did, which is just telling lie after lie after lie, to the point where it became almost impossible to track down a specific lie and focus any attention on it. And so I think there was a lot of that. Certainly climate change was an example where he would just recite numbers that were based on dubious facts. But it's also important to remember that, you know, Limbaugh had a whole conservative industry of misinformation behind him that was generating a lot of these things in conservative media, conservative think tanks. So he wasn't just on his own totally fabricating things. He was reading things from conservative media that were fabricating things. And so that was an easy defense for him in a lot of cases. He didn't need to really make up things himself, because there was a whole conservative movement out there making things up for him.
I was going to say, there really was a whole media ecosystem, even back in the 90s, WorldNet Daily, the Drudge Report. It's why, you know, sometimes I know Rush Limbaugh and others have made fun of Hillary Clinton for her comments back in the day about the vast right-wing conspiracy. But in a way, she wasn't completely off base saying that. There really was a vast network of right-wing think tanks and media outlets that sort of worked in concert with each other, or at least networked with each other, and sort of played off each other's views.
Yeah, that's certainly true. And Limbaugh was in some sense a leader of that, because he was someone who would take what might be an obscure outlet and magnify that voice, broadcast it out to an audience of millions, and really make people think that this was some true thing, whether it was something that was being fabricated about Obamacare or about Hillary Clinton and the Clintons before that. So, you know, it's hard to summarize all of that kind of daily lying for 30 years that went on. It was so much a part of the conservative ecosystem where you could fabricate these things and pretend like these things were real, and by virtue of repetition, make them true. You know, it's worth noting that Rush Limbaugh talked more about climate change on broadcast media than anyone in history. There was no anchorman, no scientist, no expert, no reporter who talked about it more, simply because Limbaugh was on the air for 15 hours a week for 32 years. Even though it wasn't the major focus of his show, it was just something he would talk about occasionally. It was something that he would repeat over and over again to his audience. And that kind of repetition especially when it was reinforced by other talk show hosts, it would have enormous influence, I think, so over the mind of the conservative movement and conservatives today.
Now, what's the connection between, I'll put it this way instead. In the 90s, with his syndicated late night television show, he's getting massive success. It's a ratings bonanza. Can we talk a little bit about who his TV producer was and how that TV producer went on to be involved in Fox News?
Well, his TV producer, he started a late night syndicated talk show or comedy show, really, a half hour show in 1992. It lasted for a few years. And his producer for that TV show was Roger Ailes, who went on to create Fox News Channel. And really was incredibly influential in all of this. And in many ways, Fox News Channel, I think, was essentially the Rush Limbaugh show translated to cable television. And in some ways it was different. The Rush Limbaugh's TV show was much more of a kind of comedy show. It was more produced. It wasn't very much like his radio show in a lot of ways, but it was the same conservative ideology. But it was bringing this idea of entertainment to politics. And so that was what Limbaugh was really innovating. And it did pretty well in the ratings, even though it had some very bad time slots. It didn't do very well commercially because there wasn't a lot of advertiser interest in it. The advertisers were much more leery of it. And unlike on his radio show, where Limbaugh carefully controlled who was allowed to advertise in order to prevent advertiser boycotts and to prevent a backlash, on television, he really didn't have that power. And Limbaugh was never a TV guy. He hated TV. He was always a radio guy. And so after a few years of doing this, he gave it up, not because it was a failure, but just because he didn't need it anymore to really promote himself. He was already a huge success. And so he went back to what he was already really familiar with, which was doing radio. But yeah, I think he was very influential in TV because he, partly because of Roger Ailes and the model of Fox News, but in many ways, he also laid the groundwork for a whole generation of comedians doing politics on late night TV. A year after his show premiered, Bill Maher started Politically Incorrect on Comedy Central, which eventually moved to ABC and was followed by The Daily Show. And all of these other late night comedians we see, in some ways, Limbaugh showed that there was a commercial market out there for political humor that really didn't exist in the early 90s on TV.
Right. And even, as you point out, political humor that wasn't in line with Limbaugh's politics. You know, you mentioned Bill Maher, The Daily Show. I think also in sort of innovating what ultimately becomes the Fox News model through Roger Ilves, I think we also see that in a way Limbaugh, as you point out in a recent blog piece for Academe, he sort of helped launch his fiercest opponents. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I mean, certainly a lot of the, you know, you see today all of these comedians doing, mostly liberal comedians doing politics on TV, whether it's Seth Meyers or John Oliver, or certainly John Stewart, they were sort of following in the wake of what Limbaugh had really started to create. Now, it was turned over to comedians who were much more liberal, and it was turned in a different way against him. But I think a lot of those comedians, you know, it's hard to say what might have happened without Limbaugh, what would have happened in the world of political comedy. But certainly Limbaugh was in some ways the first political comedian on TV in some ways, and the last conservative to be successful at doing it.
I guess, though, I was referring more to those talk show hosts that aren't necessarily in the political comedy sector. I'm thinking of maybe figures like Keith Olbermann or now Rachel Maddow.
Yeah, and certainly they also owed a lot to Limbaugh. Rachel Maddow, for example, got her start on Air America, which was a network of progressive radio stations that was explicitly created as an opposition to what Limbaugh and his imitators had done for talk radio on the right.
Sort of the opposition to Clear Channel.
Right. And even MSNBC really was conceived of in lots of ways as a as an imitator of Fox News. And for a lot of for the first years of MSNBC, they really tried to bring in some cases radical extreme conservative hosts such as Tucker Carlson, which was where Rachel Maddow got her start on MSNBC. And Keith Olbermann really was a different kind of creature. He came from the sports world of ESPN. He was an entertainer in that respect, who just lurched his way into politics. But he was so popular that it took a while for MSNBC to finally get rid of him. But in some ways, Olbermann shaped the way that MSNBC is today, of bringing, of becoming a liberal political answer to Limbaugh and his imitators.
In that sense, your blog piece at the Academe blog actually says that Limbaugh may have had some positive aspects or contributions. Is that sort of what you meant by those positive aspects?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think it's also important to note that even though you can listen to Rush Limbaugh and be horrified by him in a lot of ways, it's important to remember that talk radio was not some idyllic place of deep, thoughtful conversation in the 1980s or anything like that. It was a vast wasteland of very little political discussion at all, or very little intellectual debate or ideas of any kind. And so Limbaugh did bring politics to talk radio, and that's not necessarily a bad thing to have, even though I disagree with his politics and a lot of the ways that he did it. In some ways, you know, he was better than listening to shock jocks all day or people talking about recipes on the radio. That Limbaugh was at least brought political ideas into the realm of talk radio, and so that was an innovation that I think was positive in a lot of ways.
Well, and that innovation, I think, has also allowed progressives and liberals and people just generally maybe to the left of the GOP to, I think, more easily keep tabs on the pulse of the conservative movement in America, which, you know, it's important that we're able to be watchdogs.
Well, I think that's true, although I'm not sure how necessary it was for Limbaugh to do that. But I think one of the interesting things about Limbaugh is that he's always actually had a fair number of liberal listeners. And in fact, the audience for Rush Limbaugh of liberals exceeds the number of people who listen to progressive talk radio at any particular time. That even though liberals were a small part of Rush Limbaugh's audience, because he had such a huge voice across America, every place in the country you could drive, you could listen to Rush Limbaugh. Unlike progressive talk radio, which is almost impossible to find in most of the country. You know, Rush Limbaugh had a lot of people who listened to him because they didn't have any other choice. If they wanted to listen to someone to talk about politics, he was the only option out there. And so I think a lot of liberals are more willing to listen to him than conservatives are willing to listen to the left. But I think he also had enormous influence just by virtue of occupying so much physical space on radio stations, that for a lot of moderates who were out there listening to him, they were, you know, persuaded by him largely because they didn't hear the alternative voice. They didn't hear progressives giving a different point of view. And so Limbaugh was able to monopolize the debate in a lot of ways.
You also discuss in this article the fairness doctrine, which I want to get to that because that's going to be controversial with some of my listeners, but I think you make some interesting points. But before that, you also say that Limbaugh influenced academia. He molded generations of conservative students adept at superficial arguments and suspicious of anything liberal. Could you expand on this influence he had on students and academia?
Well, I think in part it was, a lot of professors have to suffer through the deluge of talking to students, conservative students who believe what Rush Limbaugh has told them, who've been brought up listening to Rush Limbaugh and are resistant to the idea that there might be different facts and opinions out there to listen to. So I think that's one. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to add to that. I went through a libertarian phase, I'll be honest, when I was in my early college years, and I was probably one of those students that, my teachers had to put up with a deluge of, you know, comments and questioning and blah, blah, blah. So you're totally on point with that. Luckily, I, moved away from that later on.
And that's not necessarily a bad thing to have that kind of thing. The problem was that Limbaugh brought this kind of anti-intellectualism to it, that he wasn't, a conservative thinker really having deep conservative ideas, but was instead this kind of demagogue. I think the other thing he helped do is to convince the conservative movement that you didn't need higher education. I mean, he, after all, was a college dropout. You know, he would often refer to his show as the Limbaugh Institute for Advanced Conservative Studies, sort of giving this impression, that you didn't really need this advanced degree from these liberal institutions. You could just listen to Rush Limbaugh and learn what you needed to know. And so he had that real appeal, the same kind of appeal that Donald Trump has to uneducated people. And he convinced, I think, the Republican Party to turn against academia, to see academia as the enemy of the conservative movement, as the enemy of Republicans, rather than as this wonderful thing for everybody of getting more education.
I want to stick on that point. You mentioned that Limbaugh denounced student financial aid as a plot to help, quote unquote, big education brainwash students with, quote unquote, skulls full of mush. I'm really interested in the way Limbaugh helped popularize this idea that academia is just this vast liberal conspiracy. I think he and others, maybe like David Horowitz, have really pushed this idea into the mainstream now, where there's this sense that a lot of people have that, oh, academia suppresses conservative students and they suppress conservative voices. How would you respond to that? And what do you make of that idea becoming so popular?
Well, I think one reason it's partly popular is because there is some truth to it, that academia is not a place of universal free speech, that there are conservatives who have gotten suppressed in academia. There are also leftists who have gotten suppressed. They've gotten a lot less attention by sort of the centrist values in some aspects of academia. But I think the conservatives like Limbaugh have become so much more effective at pushing this grievance of we're the oppressed minority, we're the victims here. And that was something Limbaugh did a lot in appealing, much in the way Trump has done, of appealing to white men who feel like, oh, I'm the victim here. I'm the victim of oppression and discrimination and censorship. And so Limbaugh was really a forerunner in pushing those kind of things. I think he was also a forerunner in the efforts of Republicans to defund higher education. As Limbaugh said, you know, he opposed student loans because they were just subsidizing higher education. And you saw a lot of, over the past few decades, when Limbaugh was speaking his mind every day, you saw a lot of Republicans turning against funding for higher education, which of course leads to higher tuition, more dependence on student loans. All of these things we're dealing with today are really a product of the de-investment, the defunding of higher education by a lot of Republicans. And Limbaugh was certainly one of the leaders in that effort to pitch that colleges and universities were really the enemy for Republicans, for conservatives.
Now, before we close out, unless there's anything else you want to add to Limbaugh and the views he helped popularize concerning higher education, is there anything else you want to add to that?
No. I think we've covered a lot of, there's always more to talk about with Rush Limbaugh, but I think we've covered a lot of what sort of who he represented and what his values were and what he's done to America.
So before we close out, and if we can take a few extra minutes to dive into this, Rush Limbaugh and the Fairness Doctrine. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, what was the Fairness Doctrine?
The Fairness Doctrine was a Federal Communications Commission rule established in the early days of television in the 1950s that basically said that broadcast media that had licenses had to work in the public interest and they had to give all various different points of view on their programs, and they talked about controversial issues. And the Fairness Doctrine was something that wasn't invoked very much. Occasionally you would have some presidents like Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon using it to try and persuade television stations to silence the critics of the president. But it wasn't something that had been really used very much. It had never been used to revoke a license of any broadcaster. But it was something that was seen as a powerful silencing effect, that it made broadcasters leery of having controversial political expression on the airwaves. Now, in the 1980s, Reagan is elected, and he is very much opposed to the Fairness Doctrine, and the FCC under him eventually abolishes it in 1987. And now Limbaugh, remember, goes national in his syndication in 1988, and then is immediately hugely popular. So for a lot of people, that, you know, this is the belief of pretty much everybody on the left and the right, except for me, is that the Fairness Doctrine was what enabled Rush Limbaugh, the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine enabled Rush Limbaugh to be a success, to get on all of these stations and to really get his voice out. And of course, if you're a progressive and you see Rush Limbaugh as a terrible, terrible person who had a terrible impact on America, it's very tempting to say, oh, if only we could have the Fairness Doctrine, if we could reinstate the Fairness Doctrine, we could have stopped Rush Limbaugh, we could have prevented this conservative revolution that eventually brought us Donald Trump and all of these terrible things. If only we had a government that was willing to step in and stop this kind of one-sided perspective. And I'm very critical of that approach. I don't think it's simply, I simply don't think it's the case that Rush Limbaugh was made possible by the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine. That in fact, Limbaugh and the Fairness Doctrine, you know, the rise of Limbaugh and the demise of the Fairness Doctrine were both products of the Reagan Revolution, but they really had nothing to do with one another. That what you had with Limbaugh was you had a dying AM radio band that had been superseded by FM radio with its superior music. So AM radio had to look for something to put on its airwaves. It couldn't put music on anymore, which had been its lifeblood for decades. It couldn't do news radio because that was very expensive. So it turned to talk radio. And so Rush Limbaugh had this perfect opportunity. And in some ways, you know, Limbaugh sometimes is said to have saved talk radio, but really it was talk, you know, AM radio, but it was AM radio that made Limbaugh's success possible, that it was searching for an audience and Limbaugh provided it with the opportunity to have this very lucrative audience. And the idea that government regulation from the FCC was going to be possible to stop this vast capitalist incentive for profit simply never happened. It had been done in the past by people like Jesse Helms, who found ways to get around the Fairness Doctrine even when it was being enforced. And certainly under Reagan and Bush in the late 80s and the early 90s, you know, the Republican presidents were not going to enforce the Fairness Doctrine to stop conservative voices from being heard. And if they had, or even if Bill Clinton had in 1992, after he was elected president, the Supreme Court almost certainly would have struck down the Fairness Doctrine because, you know, it was a clear example of government censorship, the government control of the airwaves. And it was done on the idea that there was scarcity of outlets, which simply wasn't becoming the case in the 1980s with the rise of cable TV. There was simply no real legal justification that was going to support the Fairness Doctrine or any political influence out there to enforce it in any way that would have really stopped Rush Limbaugh from becoming what he became.
I wanted to add to that because I think I really took in that narrative, not just when it came to Rush Limbaugh, but just the narrative that the repeal of the Fairness Doctrine is, you know, the end of, you know, a reasonable, healthy media ecosystem. I think you're saying more generally, not just with Rush Limbaugh, that, you know, that's not exactly true, that the Fairness Doctrine wasn't everything that contributed to the decline in our healthy media ecosystem.
Well, I think I'd also say I don't think we ever really had a healthy media ecosystem. But I would question just how great the media was in the early 1980s when you had three networks and not a lot of alternative voices. But I think one of the important things I would say is that the Fairness Doctrine, if it had been in place, I don't think it would have stopped Rush Limbaugh, but it could have been used to stop a lot of progressive radio and such as Pacifica Radio or even the attempt at Air America Radio. And the reason for that is that the one thing that Democrats and Republicans are generally united on is that they hate leftists. And so, especially within the DC political sphere. And so I think there would have been a lot more political support for getting rid of left-wing voices that were critical of both Democrats and Republicans than someone like Rush Limbaugh, who had a constituency among the Republicans that would have been very hard to stop and hard to overcome. There would have been a huge backlash against attempts to really try to ban him from the airwaves in ways that there wouldn't be for kind of obscure left-wing media who could be much more easily silenced. And if the Fairness Doctrine had remained in place and Donald Trump became president, I think you would have seen the opportunity for massive media repression, because that's what, you know, Donald Trump wanted to do even without the Fairness Doctrine, but he simply lacked the tools. And if we had had a Fairness Doctrine over the last few years when Donald Trump was raving about fake news and demanding vengeance, it's possible you could have seen some of those attacks on liberal media. You could have had a media that was much more compliant and less willing to criticize Donald Trump, even as little as it was willing to do.
Is it fair to say you think that maybe the fairness doctrine has been romanticized a bit too much?
I think it has. And obviously I'm very much in the minority here. Most people disagree with me in understanding the fairness doctrine and seeing it this way. But I think it's a dangerous delusion for progressives to imagine that we can give our benevolent overlords in the government the power to control what our speech and our media, and they're just going to come up with a wonderful media climate where all views get heard. I don't think that's how the government works in a capitalist system, and it's certainly not how our political system works. I think there's a great danger to progressives from a regime of censorship, and I don't see a great benefit to it. I think in some ways, as terrible as the influence of Rush Limbaugh has been on our politics, we can't think that there's an easy solution out there, that the fairness doctrine or something else could have stopped this from happening, that in fact, it requires progressives to engage in the long, hard work of educating people and getting our views out, rather than imagining that government regulation is going to provide us with a voice we don't have.
Do you think in that regard that there's any possibility at this point in time where, you know, I think the right has very successfully turned the term free speech into a term that they sort of claim ownership of now. They claim that they're the ones fighting for free speech. That used to be very much considered a left-wing cause. Do you think there's a possibility that progressives and the left can reclaim the conversation about free speech and against censorship?
I think it's possible. It's certainly what I try to do. I think part of it is progressives need to understand just how powerful repression of the left is, that they need to see all of these examples of professors and other people who get silenced because of their progressive values, and to understand that free speech is that protection for progressive ideas to get heard. And to understand as well that I think progressives don't really have a lot to fear from having a free exchange of ideas, that, you know, if there is this battle of ideas between Limbaugh's conservative ideas and progressive ideas, I think progressives are going to win a lot of those battles. I think they're going to persuade a lot of the public to hear them. But they have to find a way for the public to hear them. And the idea that abandoning free speech and thinking that, you know, in some sense, believing in the conservative propaganda that free speech is a conservative value, I don't think that helps. I think it just confirms and supports a lot of what the conservative movement has been saying, and it undermines the real value that free speech has for progressive ideas to be heard.
In closing, point blank, what is the legacy of Rush Limbaugh? And I want to just say, I should say, what is the toxic legacy? Because I think it's an extremely toxic wasteland that, you know, Limbaugh created. I think in a lot of ways, actually, that, you know, people were sort of saying, Rush Limbaugh's dead, I'm going to have a drink today. Well, you know, in a way, Rush Limbaugh has deeply impacted the political landscape in the world we inhabit today. And in that sense, I think, you know, he won in a lot of ways, which is what really scares me.
I think I agree with that. You know, Rush Limbaugh is dead, but his ghost will walk amongst us for generations to come. And you see his influence almost everywhere in our media and our politics. Everywhere you turn on Sean Hannity, you turn on Tucker Carlson, you turn on any talk radio station, and you're hearing in some ways the echoes of Rush Limbaugh but it also extends beyond that to our political system, that, that in some ways Donald Trump was the sort of the projection of Rush Limbaugh into the our political sphere. And we now have a whole generation of a Trumpist movement within the Republican Party, within the conservative movement, that will be there for generations, who absorb these lessons from Rush Limbaugh. And he's been so influential, I think, among conservative media, among conservative politicians, that in many ways, it's hard to imagine us going back to the old days, that we have to envision some different approach to politics and media, where progressives can, you know, fight against this toxic legacy of Rush Limbaugh without, you know, imitating him, or without imagining that we could regulate it out of existence. I think we need new approaches to how we can restore kind of reason and thoughtfulness and debate of ideas to our to a political dialogue that's really missing it because of people like Rush Limbaugh.
I wanted to add one more thing because it just popped up in my head. So in regards to what you're saying about we need to embrace open exchange of ideas and, you know, reconsider this idea that we can just regulate the problems out of existence, I think a lot of people would say, well, that sounds, you know, like you're saying the market will just fix everything. I don't think that's what you're saying. And I also think that a lot of people would respond to that by saying, you know, no matter what, left voices are going to be suppressed. So, you know, why don't we just allow for these right-wing voices to be regulated? Because no matter what we do, the left voices aren't going to get out there. So at least we can, you know, push these right-wing voices that are promoting homophobia, sexism, etc., out of the mainstream through regulation. How would you respond to that?
Well, I don't think, first of all, regulation works. I don't think that, you know, a country where 74 million people voted for Donald Trump is going to be a place where it's possible to regulate those ideas out of existence. But I also think we have much less to fear from the ideas of Rush Limbaugh and his followers than a lot of people seem to think. That, you know, and that may be my own prejudice as somebody who's listened to him for decades. You know, I don't see the expression of these kinds of ideas as a threat. I see the embracing of them, the believing in them, the implementation of them as the threat. And I think there's an opportunity to really learn by what's wrong about Rush Limbaugh's ideas. That's why I wrote a book quoting a lot of what he says and saying why it's wrong. But I think there's also an incredible value. And this is not saying that we have to embrace the marketplace of ideas in the sense of we have to take whatever, you know, the capitalist system, whatever whatever little pieces of the media environment they're going to allow us to have. I think we can try to work towards expressing our ideas and embracing this in places like college campuses, which are not a marketplace of ideas, where you don't get the classroom is not determined by whatever is the most popular idea on a particular subject. It is instead a place where there's an organized effort to express these ideas, and where there's the freedom to express these ideas. And I think that that freedom in those environments is an important thing to support and work for, and that we have very little to fear from Rush Limbaugh expressing his ideas, and a lot more to fear from us not being able to counter them and not being able to find ways to express our own. And so I think ultimately, as influential as Limbaugh was, he didn't change the entire political system. There was a conservative audience out there that wanted to hear his ideas, that wanted to believe in him. The Reagan supporters, the Trump supporters, who adored being told these things that they fundamentally believed, but they would have believed them anyway. And so we don't get rid of racism and sexism and homophobia and bigotry and ignorance by trying to abolish the loudest voice expressing those ideas. We get rid of it by educating people to understand why people like Limbaugh are wrong.
Last thing I'll add to that, I promise to let you go after that, is I think what we need to do is we need to reclaim a lot of the terms that have been taken from progressives in the left. I mean, you know, I always tell people one of the reasons I don't consider myself a libertarian and why I left that in my early adulthood was, when I look at it, I think the people who believe in, you know, freedom are actually the people on the left end of the spectrum rather than the right. And I think there's a lot we can do in reclaiming these ideas like free speech and, you know, this idea of liberty and freedom, because I think they're ideals that are best expressed by the left and progressives.
I think that's true. And the libertarian movement is really taken over by people who don't care so much about freedom as they do about hating the government. And so I think, you know, for liberals and progressives to try and push these ideas about liberty and freedom, I think that's the best hope we have. It's not always going to succeed. You're not always going to defeat Rush Limbaugh and his ideas. But I think the best hope we have is to try and embrace those ideas, to try and hold conservatives accountable and to embrace these kinds of principles that at least will give us, I think, a fighting chance to prevail and to argue with what conservatives are putting out.
Well, thank you again, John K. Wilson, for joining us on Parallax Views. How can my listeners keep up with your work? Or if they have any questions they may want to ask you, can they contact you in any way, anything like that?
Sure. You can always reach me. My email is collegefreedom@yahoo.com. You can read some of my work and other people's work at academeblog.org, where I'm a contributing editor for the AAUP's blog about academic issues. And so I encourage people to get in touch and to try and continue the fight against Rush Limbaugh's ideas in some ways.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with John K. Wilson, author of The Most Dangerous Man in America, Rush Limbaugh's Assault on Reason. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter @ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Rats, Martin, Gary, Amelia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views to Parallax Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.